Next week, then, is the beginning of the 5-week introductory course. And so the schedule will change. We won't start with a sitting. Rather, we'll start with me giving instructions. And then we'll sit some, and I'll talk some more, and then probably we'll sit some more. And what I'll do is introduce the basic instructions that we use for mindfulness practice systematically over 5 weeks. So you should know that, those of you who come regularly, and those of you who don't might want to come to the introductory course. And as someone reminded me last week, the week before the introductory course, I usually talk about ethics, because the tradition traditionally in Buddhism, meditation was not introduced to people first, but rather the Buddha would talk about ethical practices or ethical qualities to be cultivated before a person cultivated their mind or their heart, before they cultivated the mindfulness practice. And here in the West, if we did a 5-week introductory class in ethics, a few people would come. But if we do a 5-week introductory course in mindfulness meditation, many people will come. There's a way in which we have some preference here in the West in meditation practice, because it seems maybe like it's getting to the heart of the matter, whereas ethics seems like maybe it's kind of off to the side. So I make up for this by pretending that the introductory course starts today and talking about ethics. And what I wanted to do today is, rather than go over all the precepts and different aspects of ethics, is to focus more specifically on the second precept. There are 5 precepts which lay people traditionally take in Buddhism, and these precepts are not to kill or not to harm, not to take what is not given, not to lie, not to misuse one's sexuality, and not to engage in intoxicants or in mind-altering drugs. And these precepts are not seen as being moralistic in the sense that they're absolute commandments from God, and if you break them, the earth's going to open up and you'll be sucked into hell and such terrible things. But rather, they're taken in 2 ways. One way is that the precepts are taken as tools for training. It's very hard to cultivate a quiet, sensitive mind or sensitive heart if we're agitated by either having done some harm to other people and transgressed, and because of the remorse and the bad feelings and the memories will come back for sure for all the bad things you've done in your life. If it's serious enough and hasn't been some kind of atonement or some kind of completion around it, it'll revisit you as you sit. And it's quite surprising how for some people they'll remember things that they did 30 years ago. They come and they sit and they meditate, and these forgotten memories, in a sense, will resurface. And because of these memories, they'll call someone up and apologize. You know, you remember when I said that to you? Who are you? Well, I just called to apologize for what I said. And there's a way in which kind of the logic of the heart, the logic of our inner life, that when something is incomplete within ourselves or incomplete with our relationship with other people, that incompletion will visit us later on. And one of the ways things become incomplete is if we have intentionally harmed someone. So it's a very practical and very useful for the training of meditative mind, heart, to cultivate basically a good life, a life which is basically somewhat virtuous or kind or friendly, doesn't break the precepts, because it really supports the possibility of developing the meditative mind. And the other reason for the precepts is not for one's own practice, but rather for the well-being of the people around you. And the fundamental principle behind the precepts is the principle of not harming. So the question is not, you know, what is right and wrong according to the letter of the Buddhist law, but rather the question is, can you discern in any given situation which actions are harmful to people around you, to the world, to the environment, and which are not harmful, which are beneficial? And so the precepts are considered to be a guide for helping us understand a little bit or explore what actually is harmful and what is actually beneficial. And it's said that the condition that needs to be cultivated to really fulfill the precepts is contentment. That the foundation of actually two foundations or two precursors for the precepts or living an ethical life. One is contentment and the other is friendship. And so if you want to live an ethical life, it's best to cultivate friendly relationships with people, and it's best to find a kind of inner contentment, be content with yourself. But then the question is, there's a you know, chicken come before the egg, you know, because contentment comes from meditation practice. So, you know, you decide where you want to start. But the second precept is particularly related to this issue of contentment, not to take what is not given. I guess I'm going to have endless baby stories until he grows up. This little baby we have is now 3.5 months old. Is beginning to learn how to grab hold of things, grasp things. And as soon as he has something in his hand, immediately what he does is he puts it in his mouth. And then as soon as it's in his mouth, he drops it, or he puts it out of his mouth. And it's tremendous desire, tremendous focus on getting that thing. And he'll lean forward and kind of do what he can do. He's kind of coordinated. But he does what he can. He really wants to get that thing, and he really wants to get it in his mouth. And then as soon as it gets in his mouth, he loses interest. And this is kind of the nature of desires, often for many of us. We can have so many desires, endless desires, and there's a kind of thing that happens sometimes when they're fulfilled, that if the motivation for a desire is a deep sense of insufficiency, then, you know, as soon as you have the particular one you wanted, there's something else that'll do it, and something else that would do it. And I think that this is the nature of much of American society, which is consumer-run. Someone said that, I think maybe, I don't forget who it was, someone said that there's two solutions for how to become happy or how to be peaceful in one's life. One is to have all your desires fulfilled. And the other is to become content. And the first one is probably somewhat unrealistic. I don't think the world has enough resources to handle all our desires. But the second one, I think, is realistic, and I think that's one of the things we want to cultivate in any spiritual practice, I hope, is some kind of healthy, appropriate kind of contentment. So around desires. I learned a lot about this second precept of not taking what is not given in my time as a Buddhist monk in Burma. And seeing how other Buddhist monks, you know, kind of rules that Buddhist monks have to live under. Buddhist monks, monastics, they actually have 227 rules, precepts they have to live by. And some of them are somewhat unusual. They're not really seen as ethical, many of them. They're just training precepts. They're just very helpful for people to train themselves. For example, one of the rules for the monk is that they're not supposed to eat after 12 o'clock, noon. So you think, well, what's, you know, is that ethical? It's not particularly ethical. It's fine to eat that. Nothing unethical about eating after 12 o'clock, except unless you've made a promise not to. And monastics have made the promise not to. But the reason for it is, the rationale it's given, is that by focusing all your eating in the morning, you don't have to worry about it in the afternoon, in the evening. And it doesn't have to occupy your mind, your time, you know, your concern about, you know, getting food and cooking it. And there's a lot more time left for meditation, which is one of the things the monks, monastics, like to do. So there's many rules like that that have, you know, no ultimate ethical import, but they're useful for the training meditative practice. But one of the rules is that for the monastics is that they're not supposed to, in most circumstances, they're not supposed to ask for anything. And they're not supposed to take what's not given. And so especially that relates to food. Monastics are not allowed to keep food overnight. Actually, when it comes to noon, 12 noon, they have to forfeit ownership of whatever food's been given to them since dawn. And once they give it up at noon, they can't go back to it and visit it and snack on it, and they can't save it for the next day. But they have to just next day kind of meet the dawn with open hands and mystery and not knowing where their meal's going to come, and here they are, and what's going to happen now? And then usually they go out in their alms bowl, which is about 10 times as big as this bowl here, and they go out and they and if they're fortunate, there's people who know, you know, feel that they want to support the monastic lifestyle, and they put some food in the bowl, and the monastics will eat it, and whatever is left over at noon, they have to give away to someone else. It's a beautiful way of living because you have to cultivate trust, you have to cultivate non-clinging, you have to cultivate patience. There's a lot of wonderful qualities that are cultivated when you can't keep your food, and you don't have any money to buy food, and you don't know that when you wake up the next morning, you can't really be guaranteed anybody's going to give you any food. So there are stories of Buddhist monks going days without eating because they go to some place where people don't, either are very poor or because there is people don't understand what to do. But I'm telling you all this because one of the rules is that the monks are also not supposed to ask for things. And one of the things you're not supposed to do is to imply that you want something. So for example, you can't be walking down the street and someone is out there with a tray of food and there's a banana and an orange and some tofu in it, and you can't kind of walk and they're going to offer you something, one thing, and maybe they kind of reach for the banana to give you, and you kind of actually prefer the tofu because you haven't had protein in 2 months or whatever, and so you can't say, oh, I like to have the protein, or I like to have the tofu, or kind of, you can't even imply it subtly. You can't kind of like look in heavily in the direction of the tofu. Or you can't say anything like, indirect either. You can't say something like, oh, by the way, it's really marvelous when monks receive tofu. You can't do anything. You can't. You just have to kind of be content and take what's given to you. This training was then carried down to me when I trained in Zen monasteries. Zen monks the rules are not so strict, but in the meditation hall, the rules are as strict. And in the Zen monastery, you eat in the meditation hall, and you have bowls that are only about 1.5 times the size. And you come and you get served. People serve you, and you sit in the meditation posture like this, and people come and serve you your food, and you bow to them, and they put the rice in your bowl and you bow, and then after a while you do a little chant and then you eat the food. It's quite lovely, a little ritual. But one of the rules is you may never say no. If someone comes to serve you something, offer you something, you can never say no thanks, I don't want that. You have to always receive something. And part of it is, this is the way it was explained to me, is that when someone comes with an act of generosity to you, it's a kind of a killing to say no to that action of generosity. So you want to just receive it in your kind of goodwill and your generosity, receive their generosity. And cultivate, that's part of it, and the other part is to cultivate accepting whatever is given to you. You don't want to kind of question what's given to you, just receive it. And this is a traditional aspect of a Buddhist monk's life. You don't question, you just, if someone offers you food, you take it and thank you. So, it was a beautiful thing to have some place in my life where I could never say no. I mean, in other areas of monastic life, you learn very quickly how important it is to say no. It's one of the things you have to learn because a monastery, any institution, maybe those of you who work in a corporation have learned this, will never stop asking you to do things. And unless you learn how to say no, the institution will eat you up. So I learned in the monasteries how to say no too. But in the meditation hall, you have to never say no. You have to accept what was given to you. So if when a traditional monk, monastic, goes into someone's home, they're actually not supposed to pick anything up either, unless it's offered to them. They're very strict about it. If something's not given to them, they're not even supposed to touch it and hold it. And that's a powerful training. Not that we have to live that way, but it's nice to be reminded that people live this way, because it's actually very, very powerful training where you learn about all kinds of motivations that motivate us to pick up things casually. Many of us will pick up things casually as if, you don't even think about it. But if we stop and have to kind of investigate, why do I want to do that? We might find out that there might be a subtle greed there, a subtle desire to have it. Not just simply admiring a beauty, but it can be often kind of complicated what's going on and looking at things. And I think part of the motivation for the monastics is, not to pick anything up, is they want to be really careful that they're not indirectly implying that they want that. So if they pick up a beautiful object, then the person might say, oh, would you like that? And so they just kind of stay cool, you know, and don't take anything that's not given. I like it that this precept is worded this way. The precept is not do not steal, which I think is a more common way of thinking about this precept, especially in the West. It doesn't say do not steal, maybe because do not steal is more limited. Because not to take what is not given implies that someone actually has to give it to you, want to give it to you, before you take it. So you might see something that's kind of been lost, you know, and no one owns it necessarily. It's been lost, but if it's not given to you, maybe you shouldn't take it, or maybe you should go out of your way to find out if anybody owns it. There's a rule for the monastics: if they find some fruit that's fallen on the ground from underneath a tree, and it's on the ground, you can't pick it, but it's on the ground. It doesn't belong to anyone. The implication is often in the jungle somewhere. I believe the rule is the monastic is allowed to pick it up, but they have to yell at the top of their lungs, does this belong to anyone? 3 times. So to take what not's given, in my mind, is much stricter or much more thorough, much more challenging than the precept not to steal. Is it someone's intention to give it to you right now or not? Is it someone want you to have it? If someone doesn't want you to have it, maybe you shouldn't take it. Maybe you should be very careful and study what your motivations is, what your motivation are. And so where are some of the common places that we might end up taking what is not given, those of us in our lives and this part of the country? I don't know what some of your places are, but I know that a common one that I've had to deal with is very subtle, maybe almost petty to bring it up. But I think it's profound in its implications in the ways in which the kind of society and community we create. For example, taking from work. If someone has a pen at work, that, you know, company pens, whatever, and you need a pen at home, do you just take that pen and use it for your own private use? Was that the intention of why the company bought the pens to begin with, for you to use for your private use? To take what's not given is to take something which was not the intended use for it. To take paper from work or whatever. I don't know. It's a little bit tricky sometimes. Sometimes the sense at work is that actually it's offered for things to be used for private use. But it's a little bit tricky how that line. And I don't feel that strongly about it, except that what I do feel very strongly about when it's just kind of these kind of more subtle things. I mean, I feel very strongly for myself, but what I do feel very strongly about is the sense of trust that is developed when people know that even for these small things, no one's going to steal, no one's going to take what's not given. Then we build a culture around that, because it's all too easy, I think, when we start giving in here a little bit, we give in more and more. Or we know that we won't go very far, but the fact that we do a little bit might encourage other people to go a little bit further and a little bit further, and before kind of domino effects. To take what's not given. What about, maybe there's just petty examples, but how about in traffic? Do you ever cut in front of someone in traffic? Or do you turn your signal on and wait until someone offers you a place? Don't take a parking space. Don't take it unless it's offered, in a sense. But what are some of the ways in which some of you might be tempted or actually do take what's not given? What are some of the issues that you won't admit? Finding money on the ground. So what do you do when you find money on the ground? Yes?
I actually had the experience at a Versatel machine that was distributing, rather than $20 bills, $100. And I could have walked away with $2,000. And I couldn't do it. I had to call them and say, your machine is $600. And they were so thankful. You know, of course they could go back to see who was actually taking out, you know, the $100 bill, you know, because it's basically coded with Versatel numbers. But, and I asked my friend about it, and she said, she has a doctorate, and she said, you know, I'm really surprised because it was just really interesting, her ethics about it.
She's a doctorate in ethics?
No. She's a professor at a university.
Oh, I see.
And she was just saying, well, okay. It was just really interesting talking with her about it. She would say, you know, that a poor person should have taken the money, kept the money.
So this happened, you know, these armored trucks fall over. You know, they've had these very few times the last couple of years that these armored trucks crash or get tipped over, and all the money spills out of the open door and into the freeway, and all these people, you know, happened, I think, in Oakland some months ago, that, and all these poor people in Oakland kind of descended on the money. And the question is, you know, should they keep it or not? So why was it, if I may ask you, why was it you felt you had to call them?
Oh, I couldn't walk away with that much money. I feel so guilty. Yeah, it was guilt. You know, and it wasn't right, and I wanted the two of us to, you know, I don't know how much money that bank lost because of a, you know, a bank teller that just simply made a mistake. And the bank tellers are usually responsible for the mistakes. They have to pay the bank back.
Have you ever been charged too little for something? Mm-hmm. And the teller's not going to notice? What do you do? Do you tell them? Some people. What else? What are some of the challenges?
Well, this is more around taking life that's not given, but in a sense. That we're dealing with that. I was visiting my mother. I think their car broke together now. But, and so I don't know, the problem. I mean, it doesn't feel good to do it, but yeah, I don't know. I don't really have a good way of rationalizing it, except that I say, well, you're invading my space. And then with termites, I think, well, it's our mistake for building a house out of food, but... But, you know, it's just too much at stake.
Taxes.
Taking what's not given. Keeping what's not supposed to be kept. Yeah, taxes are good. Yes.
There was one time, this was a while ago, and it really changed me. Somebody was building a building, and they had a tree on it, and they cut it down, stacked it all up, and I said, oh, I have all wood still. And I came back, and picked it all up, and put it to me, took it home, and felt guilty and took it all back. It wasn't mine, and I haven't really taken much of anything since.
Yes.
How does this fit into the sort of bigger picture? I'm thinking that the Buddhist monk who goes to somebody else for food, not expecting, but he does rely on someone else for food. That person harvests his grains, or does they actually picking the fruit from the tree? Is the Buddhist monk then using that other person to do something that he wouldn't ethically do himself?
I'll change the example a little bit. It's maybe something that speaks a little more strongly than just picking grains. The question of eating meat for the Buddhist monk, Buddhist monastic. The Buddha was asked by one of his disciples to prohibit meat eating by his monastics, by the monks and nuns. And he refused, and he said that they should eat whatever happens to be given to them. So that the idea being that people around, lay people, are just cooking their food, you know, just cooking their own food and cooking for their own family. And as the monastic comes by their home, the people are actually going to share with them some of their own food. So it's just they're sharing what they're already cooking. They're not going out of their way to kill an animal for the monastic. However, if the monastic knows that the animal was killed for them, so they could have meat, then the monastic is not allowed to eat it. But if it wasn't killed for them, and was just killed for people, so you know, for people can have food around, then they consider it fine to eat that way. This took a more dramatic ethical question for me when I was in Burma. I was in a very large monastery in Burma, and at peak times there were maybe 5,000 people meditating at one time in this monastery. So you can imagine it was a kind of powerhouse for meditation. And there was this, so there was these big eating halls. And there was one hall where there'd be several hundred monks and the Westerners who had eaten with the monks. And they would eat, Burmese would eat a tremendous amount of pork. Everything was served in bowls floating in oil. And so it was kind of an interesting diet. But there was a lot of pork. And so the Westerners, almost all of them, didn't eat any meat. But the monks, you know, they would eat their pork quite happily. And I asked the abbot one day about this, and I tried to explain to him the laws of supply and demand. And I said, well, you know, I realize that these pigs aren't being killed, you know, intentionally for the monks. But the fact that 200, 300, 400, 500 monks are eating pig every day means that there's an increased demand for pig, and they're probably killing, you know, and probably they know that the monastery kitchen goes into the market each day to buy all this pork, and so they kind of figure that into what they have to kind of bring to market each day, and so it increases the number of pigs who are killed by one or two each day in order to supply all these. So he didn't understand. He had no clue what I was talking about. And he maybe didn't want to understand. And maybe it was a little bit far-fetched, but I felt there was a direct connection in that situation because of what I've learned in the West about supply and demand. But I don't know if it's unethical to... it's not unethical to raise rice and to grow rice and to harvest it. You know, and it's usually not something that monastics do, but it's not unethical to do that. I think the reason I brought up animals is that there, I think, is a clear example of an ethical issue. Does this kind of speak a little bit to what you're talking about?
Not quite, because I was just thinking when you were talking about ethics, and I think you were trying to tell us that this would be something that the general population could take as a lesson. And if it's something that only monastics could take, then what can I do?
Oh, yeah.
If I have to be passive all the time, I cannot be enterprising, I cannot go and take opportunities.
Uh-huh.
Someone has to do that.
Oh, I see. I don't think that I don't think the lesson is for us to be totally passive and wait until, you know, don't go to work and don't do anything and wait until someone takes care of us. But rather, I think that the lesson for me, or the challenge for me, is to use this as a reference to really study what my intention is and why I do things. And if things aren't given to me, to be very careful about it. So, for example, if we start with a farmer, I mean, a farmer has a field. I don't think he has to ask someone if he's going to grow rice in it. And so he grows rice, and then he, you know, he needs to buy plow for his farm. He doesn't go out and grab that plow, but he uses this rice that he grows to somehow find someone who's interested in selling it. And then there's exchange, and there's commerce, and there's development. Someone who develops a software program, you know, and That's just offering something wonderful to the world, you know, doing something productive and they're developing something. And then they're offering that to people through the sale and say, I need to have a fair livelihood in order to continue my life, and this is a decent livelihood is to make this much of money, and so I need to make this much money from the product of my work. And to do that in a reasonable way, I think, is healthy and appropriate. The challenge, I think, for around Silicon Valley is when is it reasonable and when is not reasonable the amount of money we ask in compensation for our labor. You know, when is it taking what's not given? When a CEO makes, you know, several million dollars in a company or several hundred million dollars a year, and there are people who are still making $15,000, $16,000 a year, you know, in the lower levels of the company. Is that taking what's not given? Someone's giving the CEO all this money, but it's very funny what's going on there, I think.
What about use of resources like water?
There's a beautiful story of the Zen master Dogen taking a dipper and dipping it into the river next to his monastery, I think to wash his face or to take a drink or something. And he takes the water and he uses half the dipper and returns the other half of the water to the river. And this story has been told over and over again in Japan ever since he did this, as an example of not assuming you can take everything and use it for yourself, but you have to also sense that the environment also has its own needs. And if we only take for ourselves and not share or participate or something or respect nature, then it's taking what's not given, in a sense. So how much, you know, nature is not saying, here, take me, you know, ever. But it's also not saying, you know, don't take me. We live on one of the great challenges for us in the modern world is what I think it was Douglas Harding called the challenge of the commons, or the tragedy of the commons. That, you know, when there are only two people on the earth, for those two people to have a car and run around and spew out all kinds of exhaust, you know, it wasn't going to have any effect on anything. And maybe it wasn't an ethical issue when there's only two cars. But when there's billions, millions, and millions of cars, and the consequence is such that the cumulative effect is so damaging to the environment, then we have to kind of see, well, it's a difficult... ethics are in part measured by consequence, not necessarily by intent. So when we look at the environment, I think we have to also look at the consequences. Yeah.
So you could see concreting up the creek so that it doesn't flood as an ethical and not just an aesthetic issue.
I think so, yeah. I mean, in a sense that, well, you can see it at a number of different levels. You can see it in the level of is there harm being created? And what is that harm? And someone who's very sensitive might say, well, if I cover up the creek with concrete, the salmon don't have a place to spawn. And I feel sorry for those little salmon, you know, those particular ones there that lay their eggs. Or someone else who have wider issues might say, wait a minute, salmon are endangered species, and there's all these rivers being, you know, there's not many rivers left, creeks left anymore in California. And given that there's so few left, and given that larger picture, I think I want to be careful. There are other things that might harm. It might harm, you know, I would like my child as he grows up to have a few places to go which are not concrete. And if it's difficult to find them because everything in the neighborhood has been cemented over, I think there's a kind of damage that happens to our children growing up and their possibilities. So the question is there harm or not? And the other question, and this is where it comes back to me, all this question, is what is our motivation? What's the source of our motivation for taking what we do take, even if we have so-called rights to take it? And I think this is where the challenge of contentment is quite important. It's possible to live a life that's content. And I think one of the great teachings that we learn for ourselves by doing a meditation practice like this is that it's possible to have a very deep form of contentment within oneself and with being alive that's completely independent of having any things that is going to create the contentment. We don't need to have. It's possible to find contentment without having a job. It's possible, or the right job, or the right relationships, or the right kind of house, or the right kind of car, or the right kind of recreational opportunities, or the right kind of movie opportunities, or the right this or right that. You know, all kind of things people are often looking for that's going to do it. It's possible to have a profound sense of peace and contentment just in and of oneself. And I don't think that's being weak or being, I think it's actually being quite strong to find that. But if we have that kind of contentment, then I think the ways in which we approach consumerism, the way in which we approach wanting things and getting things, changes quite dramatically. If what we want is more things because of our neurosis, because of our status, because of our, you know, we want our neighbors to think well of us, and so we want to have the right kind of car in the driveway, or whatever. There's many, 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 many kind of bizarre motivations of why people go out in our culture to consume, to get more, to have more. And I suspect the root cause of them all is a kind of a lack of deep contentment. And I think it's very radical, almost revolutionary, to do a Buddhist practice like this, because of we tap into the possibility of contentment within ourselves. And for me, this is what this precept is really about. The precept for me personally, aside from not wanting to harm other people, which is very important, extremely important, one of the central things about this precept, how to take what not's given, is it's really a challenge to see, can I live a life that's contented with what I already have? So when I find myself wanting to have more things, rather than saying, well, that's unethical, Buddhism says don't take what's not given or whatever, I say, well, am I doing this out of a discontent? Out of a feeling of emptiness inside of me, or out of a sense of great yearning or longing or ambition? And if that's the case, is this where I want to operate from? Is this how I want to live in the world? And I know that there's another place for me to live in, another place for me to operate in, and that is it's possible for me to be content and then come from that contentment and act in the world that way. So that's kind of the issue for me. That's kind of the measure for a lot of these things. Yes?
A question. You were talking about the rules, about the ethics. And, so it's interesting, these are rules, and every rule has its limitations. You can take certain rules and put it to extreme, and then, let's say, you will not take what's not given to you. Follow this rule, and you are hungry, you stay a couple of days and you don't eat anything. And you can either ask, or you can continue to be hungry. And so what are the limitations, and how do you decide you have to act in a different way instead of following?
I think it's a good question, right? I think it's the question is if we see this as a rule and we take it to the extreme, that we can end up into major problems. I mean, not to take what's not given and just to sit and do that in a very complete or thorough way, and no one happens to come around your house to offer you food, you might end up starving. Is that fair enough way of saying it, repeating it? And I think it's not meant as a rule that is black and white. It's not meant as a rule, but rather as a principle. And also, it's not meant as a substitute for common sense. I don't think that we're supposed to become passive and just kind of sit and wait until someone wants to give us something. But rather, it's fine to have needs. It's fine to want to do things and be motivated to do things. But in engaging those needs and those wants and those motivations in the world, do we engage with other people in a form of exchange where it's very clear the other person wants to be exchanging with us? So if I go to the supermarket, it's very clear that someone's saying, this is available for you under these conditions. I don't have to go find the manager or the owner of the supermarket and say, hey, you know, hint to the owner of Safeway, you know, you know, it's, you know, I haven't eaten for a few days, to have him say, oh, why'd you come and buy some food here? It's a, you know, they're advertising, and you know, major advertisement campaign to tell us that it's here for us. To, it's here for us to come and get under certain conditions. So I don't think we want to be, too extreme with this. It's more the principle of it. You know, if we go into a store and we don't pay for what we take, then we're very clearly taking what's not given. But if we buy it, I think it's okay. If we go into someone's house, if we're having a conversation with someone and we interrupt them while they're speaking, in a subtle way we've taken what's not given. Or if we monopolize a conversation and go on and on and on like I do, then maybe we've taken what's not given. Because other people don't necessarily want to listen to you, but they're being polite. So I think there's a ways in which to explore this principle, and there's certainly ways in which to abuse it or go too far. So I rambled a little bit, but does that speak somewhat to your concern?
Yeah, I think we tend to avoid certain judgment to the rules, and so as you said, common sense.
So the example of the monastics who follow these rules much more strictly than lay people do, their example inspires me. And I don't feel like I have to live like the monastics do, but to know that there are people living that way challenges me to try more thoroughly to find my own contentment and live from that contentment. The challenge is not to live by rules. The challenge is to live from our own contentment. The challenge is not to live from rules for rules' sake. The challenge is to use the precepts as a help, as a guide, to help us find for ourselves our own contentment. Yeah.
So it's a guideline of philosophy. You use the word guideline to be interpreted with a lot of internal questions.
I think so.
And looking at what is really taking without being offered. So there's a constant kind of judgment of the situation.
Evaluation, yeah.
It's interesting that some people will take that concept, drive it to some absurd conclusion, and use that as an excuse to cop out.
Yes.
Following principles.
Yes.
And reject the whole philosophy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting also the when you talk about how important it is to keep in mind the lifestyle of the monastics and that level. Do you look at living in a place like Silicon Valley where it's expensive to live and you have a series of compromises as an individual and now you as married with a child, compromise between or how you integrate practice with the reality of making money working in corporations? Do you see it as a series of compromises?
I personally do. I don't know. You know, it's somewhat hard to know whether I've made the right choices. But the way that I live my life, which is relatively simple compared to a lot of people around here, even the way I live my life is involves a tremendous amount of damage to the world around me. And I could, you know, take a radical stance and refuse to do any of it, and only walk to this sitting group and. But you know, I would arrive once a week then. You know, and you know that's all I need to maybe for the people on Thursday. But I'd spend the whole time walking, in between. So just having a car and driving and polluting the air and running over insects and doing everything that we do certainly creates damage. Now, is it worth it? Is the balance of hopefully the good that I do. Balance the harm that I do, and sometimes I wonder. I'm not sure, but I hope it is. And you know, it's kind of a. I don't think there's any absolute way, kind of, to measure it. You know, and decide. You know, what it is. I think it. You know, we do our best, and then kind of evaluate, and you know, it's a kind of a gut call. However, it's quite easy. I mean, some things are quite easy to decide. you know, I one of the interesting rules about monastics is there's like a whole series of rules about how to eat your food inside this big bowl. And for example, when you eat, you're supposed to eat also without any preference. You're not supposed to kind of go look for all the rice pilaf first, and then go for that first, you know, this kind of, and pick and choose. You're supposed to put your spoon in there and just eat whatever's there, you know, not kind of be finicky about it or picky, or just kind of just, you know, and all the food goes into the same bowl, right? The dessert and the salad and the soup and the, you know, everything. So you just kind of, so there's all these rules about how to eat inside that bowl. But one of the rules is you're not supposed to look over into your neighbor's bowl to see how to see how your neighbor's doing. And I like that a lot. So I don't really want to judge other people about what they do. But I do a little bit anyway. And like one you know, but I don't want to say this, but some of you might have this kind of car. So and I don't want to be an authority on what kind of car people should get. But for example, but one of the things that disturbs me quite a bit is the number of Land Rover. You know, they're built for the Sahara, right? And they're driving around Woodside, you know, and fishing to the mall. And, you know, what are they doing with a Land Rover, you know, at Stanford Shopping Center? But, you know, it seems like they're extremely consumptive of gasoline. And they are lethal. You know, I drive a small car, a really small car. And I think part of the reason people get big cars is to protect themselves. But then they're driving around with these weapons that could actually be lethal to other people. And do we really need to have these, you know, big Land Rovers, you know, driving around here? Is that going too far with our consumerism? You know, in terms of compromising, you know, what are you compromising that with? You know, why do you need a Land Rover in Stanford Shopping Center? I don't know, but so I bought a new car a few years ago. But I bought what I hoped was, you know, one of the best, one of the cars that had the least, the highest gas performance that was available, and a car that I thought would require a little maintenance and little care, and not require a lot of, hopefully wouldn't do a minimum amount of damage. And then I bought one that was relatively cheap. So that the money that I bought could be used for something else. The money that I saved could be used for something else that was wiser. So exactly what kind of lifestyle a person needs to have around here is a judgment call, especially if a person has a family and kids. You want to raise those kids and to be healthy, and so, you know, maybe the compromise would be very different if you were single. Some people decide to opt out, say, this is too much, it doesn't make any sense. Sometimes I look at the way we live, including myself in this area here, and wonder if it makes any sense. I saw a hand over there, yeah.
So the rules, if you will, say anything about... it seems to me that if you have a whole bunch of rules, that one can become kind of... abiding by rules, but it seems to me that sort of interferes with the process of finding contentment, because we're always bumping up against the rules. And so is there a rule that sort of ameliorates a set of rules so that we can find contentment? Because if we have all these rules, certainly we might become judgmental about where you are.
Well, these 227 rules for the monks?
Yeah.
Well, they categorize the rules according to severity. And the first four are the most important ones. And if you break those, the consequences are quite significant. You're no longer considered a monk. So, for example, if you kill someone, you know, that's one of the main top four. You know, don't kill anyone. If you kill someone, you're not a monk anymore. And then there's some which are considered to be quite inconsequential, and there's no real particular moral import with them. So, for example, four hours or so after I was ordained as a monk, There was this man in Burma who was scrupulous, a bit too scrupulous and uptight, I thought, about all the rules. He came up to me and said, "Oh, you have to go make a confession." I said, "I do?" "Yeah, you've already broken a rule. I mean, you're supposed to make what did I do?" "The hem of your robe is a little bit crooked." Because one of the rules is that the hem of your robes have to be lined up. So, you know, okay, I'll confess. You know, normally monks don't go around apologizing for the hemline. But there are some people who get a little bit overexcited about these things. But the beauty, so you can take it too far, but the beauty of these monastic rules is not getting uptight around them, but rather they very much, I was surprised when I had to live by them, was how much they help support and encourage mindfulness. Because it's very hard to remember to be mindful moment by moment, but somehow these rules, rather than being oppressive, actually encourage me to stay more alert in a healthy way, in an appropriate way. And I find myself much more living, much more consciously throughout the day because of them. And I really appreciate deeply these rules. And, you know, as this person, someone here said about, it's kind of a philosophy, I guess, a way of exploring our life. And one of the ways to look at it is not necessarily the obvious ways. I mean, most of us don't rob banks. But is to look at it more in the subtle ways. Do we take what's not given in a conversation? Do we take not what's given in our meditation practice? How about that? If you're sitting in meditation with an expectation, then you're trying to take what's not given. Because what's given is what's been given to you, is what's happening. I love the word "the given." Because we say in English sometimes the given is what is what's obvious. It's given that this is so. It's what's obvious in the present moment. And the fact that it's given, the word "give," you know, is like a gift. And so what mindfulness practice tries to do is to really acknowledge fully what's given in the present moment and not to try to take what is not given. And if we have an expectation and trying to make something happen in our meditation, that trying to make something happen is to make something happen which is not given. So you can understand this principle, this philosophy, or this kind of applies even to such subtle things as our meditation. And it's not an ethical issue. You don't need to go and confess. But it's one way, I think, it's one way to let these rules kind of really sink down and through our reflection inform or help support our life in a much more deeper way of than just simply taking it as kind of ethical rules. So let's end with a little sitting. As you start this little sitting, you might take a couple of deep breaths. And as you breathe out, let go. If it's easy, you can let go of all your thoughts and concerns around this topic. And just be here now with the given breath that you have, the given body that you have, the feelings you have. And then spend a few moments looking around your body and see if you can find some place in your body that feels content right now. And it can be anywhere at all, your hands, your feet, your stomach, your chest. Is there anywhere that feels content at this moment? And if you can find a place of contentment, get to know it well. Feel it, sense it. Let the breath move through it. Let yourself be as content as possible with this particular breath. With this very moment.